I went through 4 sessions of chemo. We're all battling this together. It's not just myself, it's the nurses that's battling with you. The more people that help you, you beat it.
The nurses and physicians of Dignity Health believe that while medicine can cure, human kindness helps us heal, which is why it's a part of everything we do. Dignity Health. Hello, human kindness.
Blog Talk Radio.
If you make people uniform, you can control them. If you teach people to read and think and question things, you lose control. So the best idea is to separate people if you wish to maintain a monetary system. It's called divide and conquer. By dividing people, they're not a threat. You can control them.
What we are trying is to see if we cannot radically bring about a transformation of the mind.
Hello, everyone. This is Bakari Shivanu with the Sacramento Davis chapter of the Zeitgeist Movement. In today's show, I speak with Max Wilbert, member of the Deep Green Resistance Movement. This is a 45-minute discussion, and we invite you to call in at 773-897-6189. Okay, yes, definitely. Welcome, Max Wilbert. I appreciate you coming in onto the show, and I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Hi, Bakari. Great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. And see, we also already have a couple of guests in the chat room, and if you have any questions, you can post them there. I'm also going to take questions in about 30 minutes. And I have been looking forward to this discussion for almost over a month now, and I came across this book called Deep Green Resistance, and when I downloaded it from Kindle, so I don't know how good or bad that is, but I got the Kindle version of the book, and I just really couldn't put it down. It is, I think it's a pretty, I don't know the exact page numbers, but I think it's about 400 pages. Am I right, Max?
Yep, something like that. It's
yeah,
pretty hefty.
Yeah, it's pretty hefty, but it is not this dry scholarly thing. It's a very passionate book about saving the planet, about what the challenges that we're facing here as a people, and I just couldn't put it down. And then more importantly, it also talks about strategy, which I think is an important subject that we want to get into toward the end of this conversation. And so we're going to spend about 30 minutes talking about this book, talking about the Deep Green Resistance organization, and just kind of getting into it. So, Max, could you tell us a little bit about Deep Green Resistance and also talk about your involvement in it?
Okay, sure. Well, Deep Green Resistance is first and foremost a book, and it's now an organization as well that's based on that book. And
okay.
The basic sort of elevator speech version of what we're about is that, you know, we look at the modern culture and we see what we see is a culture called industrial civilization. It's industrialized and it's civilized. You know, people live in these large cities, and it's destroying the planet. It's also destroying our, you know, our human communities. It's destroying our health and, you know, our relationship to one another at the same time that it's, you know, destroying the planet on which we depend for our life. So Deep Green Resistance is really about fighting back. That's the bottom line. And
mm-hmm.
that's why I got involved, and that's why, you know, everybody who I know that's involved got in touch and became part of the organization, is because we want to fight back. We look
right.
at these systems of power, you know, dominating the planet, and see that there are people and institutions that are, you know, pushing these destructive agendas for their own benefit, and
mm-hmm.
Those people need to be stopped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's back up a little bit and talk about the environmental issues that we're facing. I still don't think a lot of people, and I guess you would agree, that people just don't even really realize the kind of issues that we're facing here with global warming and things of this sort. We hear about these things, but, I mean, too much of the public is still in denial about what we're facing. And I really think about it in terms of my kids' generation and their kids' generation. I mean, I think we're already facing some catastrophes, but I think it's going to get even worse in the coming decades. Could you talk about some of talk about that climate holocaust that the book refers to?
Sure. Yeah, you know, I think, you know, it's one thing to hear all the scientific statistics. You know, we've all seen articles about, you know, global warming and sort of heard about it in this abstract way. But, you know, the reality is the planet is being dismembered. It's being torn to pieces every day. And, you know, you can see that in your own neighborhood. If you live in a city, you know, you're probably seeing, you know, more and more pavement and more, quote-unquote, developments. You're probably seeing more and more shopping malls and you know, more pollution in the air as the haze and the smog that you can see every day. And if you live out in the country, you're probably seeing the suburbs expanding further and further, and, you know, more clear cuts, more mining, more industrial extraction. And, you know, as far as global warming, it's hard to, you can't see it, obviously. You know, you see the repercussions of it. You feel the heat waves, you know, that are happening at such so much higher rate than they used to. And, you know, as for myself, I had some experience with this a couple of years ago when I traveled up to northern Russia with a group of climate scientists who were looking at the Arctic region, which is being really hard hit by global warming, the hardest of any region on Earth. It's warming up faster than anywhere else. And, you know, that's a big problem up there because you have this massive wilderness. You know, the boreal forest is the largest forest on the planet. And it's relatively in decent shape. I mean, compared to the Amazon, you know, the Amazon is getting chopped down like crazy to grow things like soybeans and, you know, all sorts of agricultural products. Mm-hmm. But the boreal forest, you know, it's being logged, but it's in decent shape. And so what you see up there is that, you know, as the warming continues, as the planet warms, you get melting sea ice and you get melting permafrost. And these are having positive feedback loops on the whole climate system. So, you know, imagine looking down on the North Pole and you see, you know, you see ice, right? It's white. It's bright white. It reflects all the sunlight right back out into space. You know, it's like on a hot day when you're wearing a white T-shirt, you know, you might be in good shape, but then you put on a black T-shirt and all of a sudden you're baking.
So right.
That's exactly what's happening at the North Pole, is that you've got ice melting and so you've got a white substance being replaced with the ocean, which is very dark blue, you know, almost black when you look down on it from space, so it absorbs way more of the sun's energy. And so what you see up there is these positive feedback loops like that where, you know, it's the same in the permafrost. You've got this frozen soil that's been frozen for 10,000 years, you know, since the last ice age, and it's starting to thaw out. And, you know, up there, it's those soils are the remnants of a massive ancient grassland. And, you know, I didn't know this until relatively recently, but grasslands are really great at storing carbon because they have a lot of, you know, they've got really thick roots. If you've ever tried to dig up your lawn, you know how tough grass is, how much roots it has, you know. And it can be tough to get in there with a shovel. And so all those roots are taking carbon out of the air and depositing it into the soil. So up in the Arctic, you've got tons of carbon in the soil. It's it's just a massive amount of carbon, and as it's thawing out up there, you get that soil thawing, and you get bacteria moving in there starting to eat. And just like us, you know, we eat carbon-based foods, you know, whether it's potatoes or steak or whatever it is, and then we breathe out carbon dioxide, and bacteria do just the same thing. You know, and the problem is now they're doing it on a scale that's never been seen before. Up in this permafrost region, if at least not for 10,000 years at least. So, you know, the reality is we're looking at a pretty awful situation as far as global warming. Just looking at that one issue, you know, we're looking at maybe 10 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit increase in average global temperatures by 2050 to 2100. So in the next 35 to 85 years. And, you know, that might not seem like much, you know. Right now I'm in Salt Lake City. It's kind of hot here. It's in the upper 80s. You know, that would bring us up to around 100 degrees if you were to plop it on right now. But what you're talking about is average global temperature. So that means, you know, 15 degrees in the mountains where, you know, where the snow is right now. That snow is not going to be there anymore. 15 degrees over Greenland, you know, melting the ice sheet and, you know, raising the sea levels by maybe 6 feet, maybe 10 feet, maybe 15, you know. And all these sort of multiplying impacts all over the world really exacerbating all the impacts that we're already seeing that I talked about earlier with deforestation and mining and all that.
Yeah, I think one, and I'm certainly not as educated as I need to be on this, and so I'm not trying to speak from any kind of knowledge about the issues. But I think one of the things that I keep in mind is that I tell people about global warming, and this is something what you just said. You can't understand global warming just based on a particular day. So the day is really, really hot, or the rate of the day, or the day is not that cold, or didn't snow that much this season. That doesn't give you an understanding of global warming. You have to look at weather patterns over, you know, decades to begin to see how things have changed. And that's the reason why I listen to people who study this stuff, who research this stuff, and I respect what they say more than some knucklehead and some talk show on Fox. I'd rather for the person who studies this stuff to be ultimately wrong than for this other person to be wrong and then find out by 2050 that the people that the scientists were telling the truth, they did understand it. So, you know, I think it's really to understand, that's how you really kind of understand environmental issues. You can't look at it in terms of isolated pocket areas. You got to look at average temperature changes. Are there, you know, and I know, you know, you talked about the Arctic and you talk about the other places, and we know that depending on where you live, I mean, you can feel the effects of environmental destruction. We know that the book talks about 23 million people die every year just based on, you know, bad pollution and lack of clean water. What are some other kind of indications for the fast food and TV-driven culture that we live in where people just not getting it? Because if you live in urban sectors or what have you, you're just not going to see the kind of catastrophe that is happening in terms of animals dying, insect depletion, that kind of thing. You may not just notice that in your urban, your day-to-day life. Are there any signs, you know, that are telling us that things are getting bad and that really help us understand that things are getting bad?
Right. Yeah, definitely. Well, I think, you know, you really don't have to go far to find those signs. You know, I think they're all around us. You know, one exercise that I sometimes have people do is, just look in the back of your shirt and look at the tag on your shirt, you know.
Okay.
And, you know, the shirt I'm wearing right now says Bangladesh, you know. And, you know, if I could, I'd love to be wearing an organic, free trade, you know, really wonderful shirt, feel good on your skin, you know. No sweatshops involved, but I can't afford that. You know, that's just the honest truth.
Right.
And, you know, so I think there are sort of these signs all around us of, you know, different ways that the social system, the economic system, the government, the, you know, the whole culture is really imbalanced. And, you know, I think it's really important to point out from the beginning that imbalance is, you know, it doesn't hit everyone equally, you know. If you're a person of color in the United States, you have a greater than 70% chance of living in an area where the air quality standards are not met.
Right.
So the air is really bad. Over 70% chance. Exactly. Chicago, you know, Louisiana, here in Salt Lake City, you know, on the west side, there's a bunch of refineries, and of course that's the poor neighborhoods. The people who can afford it don't want to live next to these big factories and refineries. Mm-hmm. So they're up on the hillside where the air is cleaner and the housing's more expensive. But, you know, that it's the same in that way, or whether you look at, you know, the impacts on women. And, you know, I've heard that, you know, women do more than 50% of the work in the world, but own less than 1% of the property. And, you know, in the U.S., every year, the official statistics are that every year there are more than 200,000 sexual assaults. And, you know, a lot of women who I know who work in, who work in different institutions and programs, fighting, mm-hmm. Fighting patriarchy and fighting sexual assault,
mm-hmm.
Fighting violence against women. They say those numbers are really low.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can kind of see these are variations on the same theme, and that theme
mm-hmm.
is domination, exploitation,
mm-hmm.
destruction for the benefit of,
mm-hmm.
of the few.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, it's really important to recognize that that's not human nature. A lot of people,
mm-hmm.
they hear these things and they just say, oh, we're fated to destroy the planet. It's
mm-hmm.
going to happen no matter what, because that's just, we evolved badly. We're a bad species.
Mm-hmm.
A bad mutation.
Exactly. And,
mm-hmm.
I think that's just, that's total bull,
Mm-hmm.
There are, you don't have to look very far to find cultures that didn't do the dumb things that this culture
mm-hmm.
does.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's cultures that didn't have sexual assault, there are, and there used to be even more cultures
mm-hmm.
that just didn't have a word for rape. They didn't, it wasn't even a concept, because
right.
You don't need a concept for something that doesn't exist in
right.
your culture.
Right.
And, that's the same, no matter where you look. If you just think about nuclear weapons, there are more than 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is just insane. I look at Fukushima, for example. I grew
right.
up in Seattle. So, down on the Columbia River, we've got Hanford, which is the place that refined the uranium that was used in
mm-hmm.
the bombs that were dropped on Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And, Washington, the region is dealing with the legacy of that, and has been dealing with it for 60 years now. There's giant plumes of radiation coming out of the storage tanks, going straight
mm-hmm.
into the river, straight into the fish, into the shellfish. The people who
mm-hmm.
eat those creatures, the people who live downwind of the facilities have all these rare cancers that, the officials say they can't explain.
Mm-hmm.
there's no explanation for it. And really
mm-hmm.
all you have to do is look at the flow of power in this situation. Obviously
right.
military industrial complex, you've got giant corporations involved, obviously Seattle area, Washington State, Boeing, giant defense
mm-hmm.
contractor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a continuation of the same theme. What are those companies about? They're about producing
mm-hmm.
weapons and making profit off of, off
right.
of imperialism, off of colonialism, off of going out into the world and, stealing people's land, and
mm-hmm.
destroying their forests and their mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And Max, the irony of this, and this is kind of where the Zeitgeist movement and degree resistance most connect. The irony of this is that this is happening in what we call, or what's been traditionally called, civilization. We are schooled and we grew up in school. We're taught that we live in a very civilized society, right? And we have a civilized culture. But one of the things that the book really points out is just this notion of civilization. What does it really mean? Civilization really
right.
means hierarchy, privatization of resources, exploitation of resources. It means, putting people in different classes, talks about the rape of women in terms of patriarchy. It involves racism. When we talk about a so-called civilized society, it is not as civilized as we are taught that it is. And I thought that, they spent, several pages just really talking about this notion of civilization. Even the concept of work itself is pure
right.
exploitation. I mean, we are wasting most of our lives, right, just working to survive. I mean, just to survive, while other people, a small, small minority of people, have a lot more money and resources than they'll ever need in 4, 5, 10 lifetimes. And this is where we are. And like you said, we looking at these kind of this climate holocaust is happening because of that this concept of civilization, the notion that we got to have more and more and more at whatever cost, as if there's no really no end to it, as long as we're willing to buy stuff and sell stuff and buy stuff, there's really no end to what we should be doing. And that is a really dangerous way of looking at the world. So this notion of civilization, I think, it's just seriously important. Do you want to speak to that any more about that notion of civilization?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's important to talk about, you know, because we use that term, you know, myself and the folks who are involved in Deep Green Resistance, we use that term differently than most
mm-hmm.
people do. You know,
okay.
Most people talk about civilization and they just sort of mean, you know, advanced culture. It's sort of this fuzzy idea,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I want to just break that down for a second because, you know, there's that term advanced in there. And what does that, you know, what does that mean? I think
right.
there's a lot of implications in that. And I think the root of a lot of those implications is racism. I think
mm-hmm.
a lot of that is based on, you know, this Eurocentric idea that, you know, Western European civilization is the ideal way to live and everything else is just barbarism, you know?
Thank you.
And, you know, so when we talk about civilization, what we're actually talking about is, you know, a historical phenomenon. We're talking
mm-hmm.
about something that arose, you know, around 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it first arose in, you know, the Middle East, you know, the Fertile Crescent. But it also,
mm-hmm.
you know, arose later in China and
mm-hmm.
In Mesoamerica and, you know, in a couple other places. And
mm-hmm.
what you see with these cultures that we call civilization is just like you said, we see, you know, we see militarization, we see the
mm-hmm.
concentration of, you know, political and ideological power in just a few hands. We see
mm-hmm.
an economic system that's, you know, that's designed to funnel all the wealth and all the resources to the powerful.
Mm-hmm.
We see, you know, we see a massive focus on military. Military, you know, both, well, you know, ostensibly it's always for defense, but, you know, we all know
mm-hmm.
it's really to go out there and, you know, and steal other people's
right.
land.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it can seem really complicated, but I think it's really just simple. Like, you think back to these stories that we hear of these first civilizations, you know, and
mm-hmm.
they're really held up as these really great, you know, great places and such a huge advancement. And then you really,
right.
you know, read about what this was, and it was like basically like a king and or some, you know, some religious theocracy taking control and like having, you know, basically slaves or serf laborers to, you know, to give them power and wealth and food and everything they needed. And then
mm-hmm.
they, you know, raise big armies and go out and expand their empire. And
mm-hmm.
so of course that means, you know, killing the enemy. That means, you know, almost always that means, you know, sexually assaulting the women in those communities. Almost always
mm-hmm.
that means, you know, cutting down the forest to make catapults or make your ship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, northern
mm-hmm.
Northern Africa used to have forests, and all those forests were cut down by the Romans, you know,
mm-hmm.
like 4,000 years ago to make
right.
their fleet. For
mm-hmm.
trading around the Mediterranean and, you know, and fighting their enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not really that complicated, you know. I think it's really pretty simple. There was this time 10,000 years ago when this cultural phenomenon arose, and
mm-hmm.
it's really been destructive. It's been a bad way to organize society, you know. It's been,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, that's true on a number of levels, whether you talk about, you know, bad for just the average person, you know,
mm-hmm.
Who was, you know, maybe 10,000 years ago, they were a serf or a slave. And maybe today, you know, in this country, maybe they're a wage slave, you know, and they
mm-hmm.
work 40 hours a week at Walmart or, you know, wherever they work. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they make minimum wage and they have no health care. They're not taken
mm-hmm.
care of. There's no community support mechanisms. You know, there's nothing. That's all been taken away. You know,
right.
and of course, if you look at the average person, you know, somewhere else, like I mentioned, Bangladesh, you talk
mm-hmm.
about sweatshop labor there. I mean, it's basically modern day slavery is what we're talking about.
Right.
And of course, I don't know if you've heard, but the statistics say that there are more slaves in the world today than there were at the height of the transatlantic, you know, African slave trade.
Slave trade, right? Yeah, we did a show. Right. We actually did a show on that. It's in the archives. We talked about modern day slavery. I mean, you're really seeing this kind of, again, this serious exploitation of labor trying to amass greater and greater wealth, and to also just to put it plain and simple, just to sell things. I mean, the things that we enjoy, I mean, I admit it, I have an iPhone, I have an iPad, I got a computer, all this stuff that we have, but this stuff comes at a great expense, and it really hardens me to think about, you know, the things that we do have that we do enjoy, at what expense do we have it? And we're not really examining that. The public is not allowed to even think about that. They're just getting pushed to buy more, and we're getting more dependent upon these resources every day. And this is a dangerous situation. We already looked at this question of civilization. You're absolutely right. I mean, even people that when we're talking about European imperialism, this is what we've been fighting against, that notion that this, you know, the European Western culture is something that everybody should aspire for, and that's not necessarily true. We have a disconnect, particularly when we move toward the agricultural based means of production and further into an industrial based means of production. That became a disconnect between people and their and the land and how we understand resources. There's a serious disconnect, and the disconnect is huge now, so that people are nowhere near connected to the resources that are being produced unless you live in third world countries where that stuff is being produced. That's one of the first half of the book. That's the reason why it's so important to read this book, to get the understanding of that notion in there. I want to move toward, because we're kind of getting into, I want to have some time for people to call in. Listeners, if you're there and you want to call in, feel free to do that, and I'll let you in. You know, if we're conscious enough, we know that we're facing some serious problems. I don't think enough people, they don't act like that, but I mean, we are facing some serious issues here. Like you said, in the next 30 to 50 years, I really think that we're facing some serious economic, political, as well as environmental issues in which there is no turning back. And sadly enough, we're not organizing in our movements, and we're not organizing in the way that, look, you know, we're facing some problems and we need to get organized. And so the last third of the book really kind of talks about, you know, strategy and this culture of resistance. You know, what does it mean to have a culture of resistance? And it really, the chapter on talking about liberalism versus radical view of life, you know, this kind of market-driven view of life versus more of a cooperative, sustainable view of life. And kind of that's kind of the broad view of it, but the book breaks it down even better than that. Kind of talk to us about that, the green resistance strategy and tactics for dealing with this problem.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I think it's worth touching on real quick what you said about liberal and radical, because, I think it's really important. When I use those terms, when they use the terms in the book, we're not talking about like liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. We're talking about, schools of thought. So, if you talk about like John Locke and, all these old school European philosophers, they were sort of the people who founded, the liberal tradition in thought, in how you approach the world, in how you approach structuring your society. And, I think that was really done deliberately. It was done by the powerful to consolidate and increase their power, and it's been very effective. I think, one thing that you see a lot today is you see people buying into these solutions that I think are just really bogus, and it doesn't take that much, it doesn't take that much critical thought to actually understand that something like this is bogus, but, for whatever reason, it's just been so indoctrinated into people. It's been taught to them so thoroughly from birth. They've been steeped in this liberal tradition that they can't question it, And, you know, just as one example, individualism is a huge thing in liberalism. You know, everyone's an individual. They make their own choices. Those choices are extremely important, you know, and you know, the group is less important. And, you know, there are a lot of problems I have with Karl Marx. You know, there are a lot of people who've written out there about, you know, different issues with his work in terms of racism and Eurocentrism and various problems. But I think he did a pretty good job of breaking down capitalism, you know, helping us to get a handle on that. And you know, that was one of the things that he taught us was that, you know, in this society, you know, we live in a society, we're social creatures, and so the group is really important. He called it the class, right? The class struggle. So, you know, he wrote about the working class, you know, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. And, you know, that's true today, you know, and obviously it's slightly different than, you know, back in the 1800s when it was, you know, sort of this boom time in, you know, industrialism and, you know, factories in England and all that. And that's what he was really writing about. But the basic idea is the same, you know. We're social beings. We live in groups. We organize ourselves in groups. We have common cause with each other. And, you know, for me, I don't really have common cause with the Walmart family. You know, they're multi-billionaires, and here I am, and I can't afford, like, one organic cotton T-shirt, you know, as much as I'd like to. Like, you know, I'm getting the rent paid, you know, but I don't own a home, you know. I don't own the means of production. You know, I can't go out and invest my money in something and not do any work and then just get more money coming back to me. I don't have that, you know, I don't have that leverage, that power. And so, you know, I think one way that this shows up in terms of environmentalism is you see a lot of focus being put on sort of individual lifestyle changes. Like, I'm going to be a vegetarian, or I'm going to turn off the lights every time I leave the house, you know. You know, I'm all for turning off the lights, for your electricity bill, if nothing else. But, you know, as for vegetarianism, is a whole other conversation. You know, I think, you know, that's something that's in the book in terms of the destructive nature of agriculture, you know, as it's been practiced for the most part for the last 10,000 years. But, you know, it's all about these individual choices, and that's why you get these insanely popular books like, you know, 50 Ways to Save the Planet. And every one of them is, you know, buy this or don't buy that. It's basically, you know, 50 capitalist ways to make yourself feel good. That's what it really should be called, you know. And meanwhile, you know, the broader systems of power go on, you know, trundling around the planet, destroying everything. And, you know, I think another place you see this is in terms of racism. You know, you see a lot of white people, you know, and you know, I'll be the first to say, you know, I'm white. I was raised in this white supremacist culture. You know, I carry the legacy of that. You know, I carry that racism inside me. I'm trying to get it out of there. But, you know, I see a lot of white people talking about how, you know, they're not personally racist, and so they're doing their part, you know, by being nice to people of color. And, you know, really that's not what it's about. You know, you should be nice to people of color, you know, if they're your friends or if you have reason to be nice to them, of course. But, you know, there's a lot more to it, you know, whether you talk about the prison system that disproportionately, you know, incarcerates people of color and the whole criminal injustice system, or, you know, redlining and how, you know, how banks use their economic power to further marginalize and impoverish communities of color. You know, there are all these different institutional forces collaborating to keep people of color down. You know, they're not just doing it for fun. They're not just doing it because they want to. They're doing it because it benefits those in power. You know, they make money. They get power. They get people volunteering to go fight their wars, you know, because they have no other option. And so that was sort of a tangent in terms of liberalism versus radicalism. So do you want to take us back on track? You were asking about strategy, I think.
Well, I think that you did that. It's a little bit of a tangent, but I think that it's important to think about that because, one, I mean, there are some conscious decisions or, you know, theories made about liberal thought, but there's also just people naively just kind of internalizing it. Just like, you know, we talk about, you know, we have these racist institutions and we white people internalize the racism. I think people of color also internalize racism and they turn it back on themselves and each other. I think we do that. We also internalize these class exploitation views about, you know, some people have a right to have more than other people. Some people deserve to have billions of dollars, even though other people are making $2 a day. I mean, this is schizophrenic. This is a psychological problem that we have in the world culture. I mean, I ask people, you know, do you think it's okay for an individual or a family like the Walmart family to have billions of dollars worth of wealth? And people say, well, yeah, I mean, they should be able to have a right to that. Well, first off, do you understand how much $1 billion is, A? And then two is, how do you spend $1 billion in your lifetime? So people don't even stop to think about, you know, just what this oppression means and how we set things up. I think that some people consciously, they just make a decision, look, I'm going out for self, I'm going to get mine. I don't have to be down. I don't have to care for my brother or my sister. I don't have to do that. It's in my right to be able for me to get as much as I can while I'm living. Whereas other people, which is a very few small segment of the population, rural population, who sees, no, we need to act like our mothers, for example. We need to take care of each other. We need to build an economic situation that is taking care of each other, not allowing anybody to make billions of dollars worth of personal wealth. That is just, to me, I don't know why we're not just going into the streets just being outraged by that level of wealth disparity in this country. It's just unacceptable to me. So I do think that there's a definite connection between this liberal viewpoint and it's kind of influenced the kind of the welfare state. You know, the United States has gotten dependent upon the welfare state as to say, well, all right, well, at least, you know, if you don't have a job, you don't have any money, we'll give you some food stamps every month. And that's a liberal, even though it came out of a progressive idea, a progressive movement, it really has, you know, developed as a liberal view of how to solve the disparity between the rich and the poor. And we got to get past that. So I think one of the things that's important that your organization is looking at is tying capitalism to environmental destruction, not looking at them as separate. And so the book gets into this notion about strategy and looking at kind of four categories of action, you know, how we address a problem, that is legal remedies, direct action, boycotts, and spirituality. I forget what it says about spirituality. But could you talk about, you know, this concept of how we deal with, you know, how do we attack this issue, these problems?
Right.
How do we, yeah.
Sure, yeah. You know, I think, you know, I'm going to say as much as I can, but I think this is one of the most important parts of the DGR book is, you know, a lot of the book goes into looking at historical movements for justice and, you know, how they worked, how they organized, and did they succeed or did they fail and why? And I think it's crucial that we learn those lessons. It's really crucial because a lot of people are just kind of, you know, they're off driving before they've gone through driver's ed at this point, you know, in terms of working for justice. And so, you know, looking at those movements that have been successful, we've come to some conclusions. And I think one of those that you mentioned briefly was the culture of resistance. That's something that you see again and again historically, is that when a movement is successful, it really it has built, you know, one of the prerequisites for that success is building that strong internal culture, you know, building a community that really encourages and promotes and honors fighting back. Because what you're seeing right now is, you know, we live in a world where, you know, most people my age if they go to a protest or something, then maybe a lot of their friends are going to be like, you know, dissing them and saying like, why are you doing that? You know,
and
instead of encouraging them and, you know, sort of lovingly trying to promote those feelings of wanting to fight for justice and wanting to help people and make the world a better place, you know, you kind of see this super ironic postmodern approach that says, you know, screw it all, let's just party. And that's just what I see in my generation. I think in a lot of, you know, older folks who lived through the 60s and the 70s, they sort of have this other perspective, which is that, you know, they saw COINTELPRO and they saw state repression. You know, they saw the Black Panthers getting gunned down and, you know, these movements being squashed. And, you know, they're really sort of running scared. And, you know, that there's good reason to run scared. You know, we're talking about the most powerful institutions and people on the planet. And they certainly don't have any moral scruples about, you know, about stopping us using whatever, you know, whatever means they think necessary. You know, up to and including killing people, you know, or locking them up for life.
Yeah, we saw that in the Occupy movement clearly. That was clear in an Occupy movement,
Right, and so, you know, that's why I think the culture of resistance becomes so important, is because, you know, you need a community that encourages people to do what's right, to do the right thing, you know. And I think the root of that is, you know, having a desire for justice and having love for, you know, it was Che who said the real revolutionary is guided by love. And, you know, of course, there are some problems with him in terms of, you know, some stuff that went down in Cuba. But I think that's very true, you know. The revolutionary needs to be guided by love. And that doesn't mean you don't have rage. That doesn't mean you don't have hate. You know, I don't necessarily think those things are bad when they're appropriate, you know. Sometimes they're bad. But, you know, sometimes love is bad, too. Sometimes people love people or love things that they shouldn't love, you know? And
yeah.
It becomes a really destructive thing.
They love naive. Yeah, you can have a naive love.
So, you know, you mentioned those four categories of action, legal remedies, direct action, boycott, and spirituality. And those are sort of broad categories. And I think they can all really be applied in good ways and bad ways. So that's, you know, DGR is not trying to be dogmatic and say that, you know, only one thing will ever work. You know, we'll say the strategy in the book, you know, lays out what we think is the best chance for success given the current situation. But, you know, I'm not going to be out there telling people what you do is wrong, you know, unless it is really wrong. You know, but if they're kind of on the right track and they're getting stuff done, you know, then, you know, by all means, go for it. But, you know, a lot of people, they look at legal remedies, they look at the system, they say we can't work within the system, you know. And I can understand that, you know, I feel much the same way myself. But at the same time, you know, you can't deny that, you know, the civil rights movement had a huge impact, you know. And you know, the Black community would be in a much different place today if, you know, if that movement had failed. And, of course, they didn't only use legal remedies, you know, and that's another characteristic of successful movements is, they do a wide variety of stuff, you know. They don't just stick to one thing. They try a whole bunch of different things, and it all kind of comes together and helps push things forward. You know, there's some great legal work going on, you know, whether it's even like folks who are doing Endangered Species Act stuff, you know. I really support that stuff. I don't think it's going to solve things in the long term, but, you know, maybe they keep the logging stopped for a year or 2 years or 10 years, you know. And... That, you know, that's real. That's an impact in the real world. And, you know, and it's the same when you talk about direct action. You know, there are people doing tree sits right now. You know, people doing blockades and lockdowns. And you can talk about the folks who just went down and crossed the border, the Dream Team folks who went down and crossed the border you know, were picked up by immigration and they were, you know, quote unquote illegal. And, you know, according to those arbitrary borders that were completely made up by white people. And, and, you know, that was an example of a direct action. They're helping to push the movement forward. You know, they're really raising a lot of awareness, putting pressure on politicians and moving things forward. And then, you know, another type of direct action that the book talks about a lot is infrastructure destruction and, you know, sabotage and things like that. Because, you know, you look at the modern world today and the powerful are so dependent on these systems like electricity and, you know, fossil fuels and these things that are, you know, they're physical things that are happening in the world. You know, there's telephone lines, there's electricity lines, there's pipelines, there's transportation systems. You know, these things exist, and it really has a detrimental effect on those in power when you interrupt those systems. And, you know, just as a brief side note there, to go back to what you said about food stamps, you know, it's like there are, you know, there are a lot of people on food stamps, and I myself have been on them because I was just in that situation. And, you know, I was glad that, that sort of safety net was there. It was helpful to me, and I don't really have bad feelings about taking the government's money because they're probably going to spend it on war or something else, you know.
That's right. That's right.
But at the same time, like you said, you know, they're making people dependent on them when what we really need is we need communities that are self-sufficient. You know, we need we need people banding together and being able to take care of themselves, you know, growing their own food and you know, I'm learning to hunt because, you know, I don't want to be dependent on, you know, factory farming and, you know, the grocery store to get me my food. You know, that system is not always going to be there. So to go back to those four categories, the next one is boycott. And, you know, that that's a broad category. It doesn't just mean not buying something. You know, it could be like withdrawal or, you know, sort of broad category of tactics. And, you know, it can be done in a really smart way or it can be done in a bad way. And, you know, you saw, in, of course, the famous, you know, bus boycott in Montgomery. And, you know, people have this idea that, that Rosa Parks just sat down on the bus one day and refused to move, but the reality was she was an activist for decades beforehand.
Right, and
you know,
she wasn't the first one to sit down either. Right.
Right. Yeah, there were several people who did it before her, and you know, just didn't really light the fire like hers did. You know, hers was the one that kind of got things going really. And but you know that she had a whole culture of resistance supporting her, you know, and they had enough people that they could do a direct boycott of the bus line, and it turned out to be ultimately effective, you know. So, you know, when people talk about direct boycotts like that in the modern world, you know, I try not to buy from Walmart and, you know, buy these really nasty products, of course, you know, as much as I can. But I think it's really important that we understand that, you know, 600 million people aren't going to stop shopping at Walmart tomorrow, you know.
No, they can't. They can't do it.
Right. People are, you know, people are living in poverty, and that's where the cheap prices are. And, you know, that's not the poor people's fault. You know, that's the fault of the system. That's the fault of Walmart and capitalism and the government and, you know, the whole history.
Right. It's not a notion of just fighting against, you know, not just shopping at Walmart. That's not going to solve the problem. Even if we stop shopping at Walmart, I mean, that's going – if we did it on a mass level, I mean, sure, that would have a serious impact on the economy. But at the same time, we would still have to fight against the kind of capitalist system that feeds businesses like Walmart and corporations like that. One of the things I wanted to point out, piggyback on, is the book really studies about, you know, looking at, say, the Black Panther Party, the African National Congress, the Civil Rights Movement in terms of different organizations that's made up of. A lot of people don't know that, you know, King was actually a part of an organization called SCLC. There were other organizations in that movement like SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And there are different organizations that made up that movement. And so, and they had conflicts. I mean, they had problems. But they had spent a lot of time strategizing, you see, and I think that's where we kind of missed in the Occupy movement, in progressive movements. There's not enough emphasis on looking at, one, what the book does is study the history of these organizations and movements, study them in terms of what worked and what didn't work, and how we can apply that to modern day resistance culture.
So that's right. What's missing, I think, in the kind of the modern day progressive movement is we don't understand anything about strategy. I don't think, quite frankly, that TZM, the Zeitgeist movement, has a real firm understanding about strategy, even though I do think they get a piece of the question about, you know, education and awareness raising. You know, the videos definitely do that. Some of our online work definitely does that. But we still are nowhere near really unpacking that notion of what it means to have a strategy and what are those different types of strategies to use. I totally agree that we don't want to put all that eggs in just one basket. We have to look at our organizational capacity, you know, how many people in membership, what's our core level like, what is the kind of, where are we organizing, you know, the environment in which we're organizing in. I was able to benefit a lot from that from people who came out of the 60s and the 70s movement. A lot of people are dead now, but I was able to learn a lot from those people. And I think there's a lot of books right now and this book that we're talking about definitely does that. We don't have to just always go put out these different fires, you know, a march this week and a march next month and another march. Sometime between those marches, you got to group together, right? And have a study group, have a work study group. I was fortunate to come up in a work study group where we studied. We had a book list. And so I think that's what is needed. I think this book is one that I would love to sit down and study with 4, 5, or 6, 10 other people because it is so important that we not just do the action but also have a theory behind what we do, not just blindly do stuff because it looks right, it looks really cool to go out there and march. I mean, that's fine to march, but why are we marching? What is the ultimate goal of that? We have about 9 minutes left. Could you talk a little bit about, say, the difference between, Deep green resistance and, say, Greenpeace or Gil McKibben's organization. I don't want to get into trying to say that one is better than the other, but kind of like maybe situate the difference between your organizations.
Sure. Yeah. You were breaking up a little bit. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can probably get through that. Am I okay now? Can you hear me?
No, you're still breaking up, but I heard your question, so I could just go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, as far as differences, you know, I think there are quite a few, honestly, you know. I think there are a lot of, well, one of the first things, you know, you look at big NGOs like Greenpeace, like 350.org, like Sierra Club, and, you know, we have to be real that these are big business. I mean, these are organizations that are talking about budgets in the tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of political repercussions that come with that. You know, that money doesn't just come out of nowhere and it doesn't just, you know, have no implications whatsoever. You know, that's not to say that, you know, movements don't need money because, you know, I've done speaking tours and stuff where I need gas money and I have people chip in, and, you know, that's, of course, that's the world we live in, you know, and we work to change that. But, you know, I think you look at a lot of these movements and I think, you know, honestly, I think they've been corrupted by, you know, by how big they've gotten. And they've really become these sort of buffers between those in power and angry people, you know. You look at... you know, these organizations, and what you see, I think, is a lot of people who donate and, you know, maybe they'll get signatures for them or, you know, they'll volunteer and do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And then they walk home and they feel so good about themselves. You know, and the reality is Sierra Club, up until a year or two ago, was taking money from the natural gas fracking industry. And, you know, 350.org is getting their money from, you know, some of their money from the Rockefellers. And, you know, and Greenpeace, a lot of the people who, you know, who used to work at Greenpeace high up in the organization, like, you know, CEO and some of the top officials, you know, they now work for the logging industry or they now work for the mining industry. And so you see kind of this revolving door, just like you see, you know, in Washington, D.C., you know, with military contractors. You see the same thing, you know, with these sort of giant environmental quote unquote organizations, you know, where it becomes a political game, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a way that they take people's legitimate anger and grievances and they sort of channel it into these really ineffective things, like, you know, buy your stop global warming coffee mug, and you know,
right.
And you've done your part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, of course, there are a lot of people out there who, for whatever reason, they have families, or you know, they have health issues, or whatever reason, they can't actually, you know, be on the front lines. But I think,
mm-hmm.
you know, a successful movement needs people doing all sorts of things, you know. And I think
right.
it's a big mistake to sort of glamorize, you know, the people who are maybe on the front lines, you know, of a protest or direct action, or, you know, the people who are really the warriors, and then really undervalue the contributions of the people who are cooking the food or making sure they can get to where they're going, or, you know, maybe even just the people who are giving them support in their personal lives and really, you know, enabling them emotionally and, you know, personally to be able to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's massive. It's a huge contribution. I think it's been a big downfall of a lot of movements in the past. And, you know, that's why, you know, the bit in DGR on spirituality talks about how, you know, spirituality can be a really bad thing for a movement, for a
mm-hmm.
community. You know, it can be false hope. It can be, you know, belief that God or Jesus or, you know,
mm-hmm.
the Almighty One is going to come save us, and so we don't need to do anything. But it can also be, you know, a source of strength and a source of, you know, a source of power and sort of commitment to everything. You know, one of my favorite quotes is from Frederick Douglass, you know, who he escaped. He was a slave and he escaped. And he said, you know, I prayed for freedom for years, but I never escaped until I prayed with my legs.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, what that means to me is not, it doesn't mean don't pray. It means pray and then go do the work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not a fan of the patriarchal, you know, monotheistic, authoritarian mm-hmm. religions that dominate the planet, you know. But I think, you know, if we're talking about a spiritual connection to the living world, you know, to this living, breathing world that has given birth to us, and you know, the miracle of life, you know, then that's something that I can get behind. And, you know, it's something that you've seen in a lot of successful movements, you know, including just recently, you know, I've been organizing with some different Native communities around, you know, so-called USA, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is really Native land. And, you know, a lot of these folks are practicing their traditional religions and you know, they're practicing their ceremonies and their ancient ways, you know, that they've done for
mm-hmm.
so long that have worked for them. And,
right, trying to stay connected, keep
right,
them connected.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
mm-hmm.
I, you know, I think that's important. It can be a big source of strength and comfort and, you know, perseverance through hard times.
You know, Max, we're coming up to about a minute and a half, and I really want to say I appreciate this conversation. It has been very fruitful. We have several guests in the listening live right now, and we will also have this show archived. I hope that the sound was okay enough to listen to. I know the sound is always not as good as on Blog Talk as it needs to be. But I really appreciate you coming in and talking and really breaking this down. This is a topic that we need to keep coming back to. And the book, if you can get a copy of that, go on the website. The website is deepgreenresistance.org, deepgreenresistance.org, and you can order a paperback copy of the book there. And if you're an Amazon person like myself, you can get one downloaded from there. But it is well worth reading and getting into a study group. And if anybody's interested in, you know, if anybody's interested in having that discussion with me or people, other people, I'm definitely here locally here in Sacramento. Definitely give me a call or write me, and I would definitely want to be a part of that. Max, again, I really appreciate you calling, and I want to maybe hopefully we can have you back on at some point to talk further. Is that okay?
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks a lot, Vicari. I enjoyed the conversation. And if you
want,
I could give you my email address after the show, and you could put it up if people want to get in touch with me directly.
Okay, definitely, definitely send that, and I will put that in the show notes, and also put it on the our chapter website so people can contact you directly from there if you want to do that. So I really appreciate you calling in. Please keep in touch and check out those videos of the Zeitgeist Movement. I think there's a lot of connections there, but quite frankly, I think we can learn a lot from what you guys are doing in terms of strategy and tactics. I think we definitely need to do that. Appreciate you calling in.
Okay, thanks so much, Bakari. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's it, folks, and I thank you again for calling, for listening to the show. And we're going to have another show. Join us on September the 8th when we compare and contrast the theories of scientific socialism and resource-based economy. If you want to hit me up at thankzeitgeist@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Today, Bridget Griffin shared a video of her daily yoga routine, two self-help articles, and her new blog called Build Your Inner Bridge with Bridge. Girl, your sharing has turned into oversharing. No worries, Bridge. Geico has some info worth sharing with your 7 blog followers, like how you could save money on your car insurance, update your policy, and report a claim just by visiting geico.com. How's that for building your inner bridge? Bridge, Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.